Does PRN inspire you? Does PRN make you want to learn more? Does PRN help you to see inside yourself, to be yourself, to grow, and to do? The truth is, we all need each other to be, to grow, and to do. So, we're asking that you check out the PRN.fm.
From New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Empowerment Hour. Today, you're going to learn how the coconut oil derivatives, I'll go into that in depth, is effective and safe as an antiviral against the novel coronavirus. How about that? Manila University, the Philippines. Also today, we're going to have a special guest, and that guest is Dr. James Lyon Weiler, and he is the director of the Institute for Pure and Applied Knowledge, which performs research in the public interest aimed at finding ways to reduce human suffering. And his research program is currently focused on aluminum toxicity, autoimmunity, and the differences in health outcomes between highly vaccinated and unvaccinated children. However, he is also an expert on viruses, including the Ebola virus, and he believes, and we're going to get into this in depth, that the Chinese intentionally manipulated the genes either to do one of two things, to make this virus a weaponized virus, or to make this virus a stronger, let's say, vaccine, an adjuvant. And time will tell. Now, on tomorrow's show, we'll be taking a different approach. We're going to have an outstanding speaker. He's been on this program many times, and he is a unique person. He is Professor Francis Boyle, Professor of International Law at the University of Illinois Law School. And he's had a long career as an anti-war activist and upholder of human rights. And by the way, he served as a counsel to Bosnia and Herzegovina and was legal advisor to the Palestinian delegation during the Middle East peace negotiations, 1991-3. He also was on the board of Amnesty International, counsel responsible genetics. And he actually drafted the legislation for what became the Biological Weapons Anti-Terrorism Act of 1989, which was signed into law with every single member of Congress, both in the House and Senate, signing on board to it. He believes that there is evidence that the coronavirus strain was an engineered weaponized pathogen. So we're going to have two different points of view, one today, one tomorrow. You're going to learn a lot about this. That's our whole program. So I want to begin by first stating back in the mid-1980s, right through 2000, with the Tri-State Healing Center and our entire medical staff and all of our nurses, they were giving a drink each day to every patient, those with autoimmune conditions, those with cancer, but the 1,200 people that we treated with AIDS-defining illnesses. Because at the time, I was fully aware that there was lauric acid, that's L-A-U-R-I-C, and monolaurin, M-O-N-O-L-A-U-R-N, and they were known to have significant antiviral activity. And lauric acid is a medium-chain fatty acid, which makes up about 50% of coconut oil. And it's naturally produced. Monolaurin is a metabolite that's naturally produced by the body, its own enzymes, upon ingestion of coconut oil. And sodium lauryl sulfate, a common surfactant that is made from lauric acid has been shown to have potent antiviral properties. Lauric acid and monolaurin are used in a wide range of products for their antiviral properties. And I also did three different types of herbs that were strongly antiviral, including echinacea, astragalus, and olive leaf extract. Podiarco is actually antibacterial, but I would use it at the same time. And bitter melon. Bitter melon, strongly antiviral. So every day these people with AIDS-defining illnesses would be there anywhere from 1 to 4 hours, depending upon the protocol I'd given them. But every hour they get one of these juices. And the whole idea was to disintegrate the virus's membrane. The antiviral activities of lauric and monolaurin were studied back in 1979 and later 1982. And I believe I was the first health center in the world to actually use it on all the patients, every single patient. In fact, we hired people that did nothing from morning until night except stay in this little juice room and juice. Gallons upon gallons upon gallons came out of there every day. Of course, what we knew at the time, and it's been fully supported since, is that monolaurin was able to reduce infectivity of human DNA and RNA envelope viruses and cell cultures by 99.9%, and that monolaurin acted by disintegrating the virus envelope. So one more way that we can help with all viruses, herpes virus. I've reversed herpes in so many individuals. Herpes 1, 2, and 6, the most deadly is 6, because that was associated with AIDS symptoms, and it was the great work of the gay publication, The New York Native, and Charles Ortlieb and Nina Ostrom, two of its editors and publisher. They're the ones, more than anyone else, who made us conscious of the cofactor susceptibility in people with AIDS to human herpes 6 and also chronic fatigue syndrome. In any case, what you want is you want to get at that virus. And we've seen monolaurin inhibit the Argentine hemorrhagic fever virus. So whole lot going on there. So when people think, coconut oil, what's it do? If they had a background in science or were willing to be patient, look at the actual literature, then you'd see how strong the antiviral activity is of coconut oil and caprylic acid. That's what you get when you have grapefruits and you juice the seeds, that bitterness. And monocaprin, that's monocaprin, which also shows promise against viruses, especially HIV-1, and that's in the scientific literature. And by the way, caprylic, C-A-P-R-I-C, capric acid, accounts for about 7% of coconut oil. Thus, at least two fatty acids in coconut oil and their monoglycerides have strong antiviral activity. And that's why I always suggest if you have a cold or flu, if you're going on a trip, just simply take yourself 3 ounces of coconut oil and mix in that coconut oil your a little bit, maybe let's say about a gram of pure bee propolis, and then about 1,000 milligrams of olive leaf extract and about 300 milligrams of echinacea and 300 milligrams of astragalus. And then you can take 3 ounces of a liquid on an airplane, and then you take 2 or 3 of those bottles, and then at the beginning of your trip, I always do this, and no one ever notices. I take a little bit of coconut oil, and I just massage it around my lips and on my gums, around my nostrils, on my hands, and that protects me on the flight. Simple little things, nobody notices, you're not drawing attention to yourself, but it works. So just to conclude this, there's lots of animal and human studies supporting the potential of coconut oil and lauric acid and its derivatives as effective and safe agents against viruses, all viruses. And I would even suggest that this be shared, since we have people all over the world listening to this program. We have people of all backgrounds, lay people and Nobel Prize winners. So I suggest that you pass it on, that those who are in the area, that they start using coconut oil 2 to 3 times a day, and that can help. All right, it's been shown. I would go up to 3 tablespoons daily, and you're going to get about 800 milligrams of monolaurin. And monolaurin is it's safe, but it's really effective. Separately, from the University of Tsukuba in Japan, comes a study about cholesterol-lowering agent in olive leaves. Now, we know that the olive leaf extract, we're not talking about the olives, but the tree that you grow the olives on, the leaves of that tree have significant antiviral activity, immune-modulating activity, and now we see cholesterol-lowering activity. So it's also good for diabetics. And this was published in the Journal of Nutrition Research. So why? Because there's a phytonutrient that is known to lower your blood level, lipid levels. And it's one of the most abundant antioxidants. It's found in the fresh, unripe olives. It's also in the olive leaves. It's called oleuropein. OLEUROPEIN. And you can get it in olive leaf extract. So it's good for diabetes, it's good for lowering cholesterol, and it's good for obesity. All three. Then we have from the University of British Columbia another study, there's so many now, on light therapy. Light therapy holds promise for people with bipolar disorder. Light therapy, consisting of daily exposure to bright artificial light, is already a recognized line of treatment for people affected with seasonal and non-seasonal depression symptoms, but much less is known about the potential benefits of light therapy for people with bipolar disorders, one of the leading causes of disability. In a meta-analysis, meaning they look at all these different studies and then they analyze the different aspects of the studies to see if there's some common denominators. And this was published in the respected Canadian Journal of Psychiatry. A professor in the Department of Psychiatry and director of Mood Disorder Center and researchers found that there's a lot of evidence that light therapy reduces symptoms of bipolar, of depression. It's very good. And also the flavonoid that I'm going to tell you about stabilizes circadian clocks, especially if you're diabetic. This University of Geneva, and this is published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, meaning it, this one nutrient impacts the circadian clock disruptions associated with type 2 diabetes and the ability of the flavonoid that occurs in citrus peel, orange, lemon, lime, and grapefruit. It is called nobiletine, N-O-B-I-L-E-T-I-N. One more thing that can help you get a good night's sleep if you are, let's say, diabetic. And finally, from the University of New Brunswick, which is in Canada, one more study shows that the more time you spend greening, meaning around trees and nature, the more it can do for your health, and the longer you're going to live. This was published in the Lancet Planetary Health Journal, and they're saying right up front that those people who were in this study, and this was a 1.3 million people, and it was an 11-year study, and they studied people living in the 30 largest cities in Canada, and they found that those individuals who spent the most time in nature around green space substantially reduced the risk of premature death. How about that? And just one final thought on this. I recently finished part one of a clinical study. Now we're going to part two in about a month from now, month and 2 weeks. And I want to know why did, if everyone did the same identical protocols, why was there such a radical difference in one group who made phenomenal improvements, improvements that were so important that if you simply, one of the top scientists in the world told me this, said, Gary, if this person told me that these changes occurred in their objective biological aging markers in their blood, I would not believe him. But because I saw all this with my own eyes, you've broken through a whole new paradigm. You're establishing a whole new paradigm if you can duplicate it. Okay, so now we're going to duplicate it. But why is it that five of the people had no improvement at all? And I was thinking about that. And the answer finally came to me. Green time. One, and the person that got the most green time had the greatest results. Now, if they were all taking the same number of juices and same supplements, and they had to, same food they all ate, and same exercising in the morning, which they did, and in the gym, which they did, and other things, why is it that some didn't? Because some people were brought their body to a place but left their mind back in its conditioned orbit. It was still in that enculturated environment. I got to call people tonight. I got to get on the phone. Got to argue with people. I'm not going to go to bed at 10 o'clock so I can get up early. I'm going to stay up till 2 in the morning. I'm going to talk with my essential other and listen to them scream at me. All this crap that goes on. And you think, okay, so what? Now I know, boy, did these people teach all of us a lesson that when you don't take that 2 hours a day, now we insist, I'm going to be there and insist everybody goes with me into nature for 3 hours every day. It's not an option. It's part of the protocol. Go into the butterfly house and sit and meditate with the butterflies and listen to the soft, soothing, meditative music. And or go down and watch the swans. But you've got to be in that nature. These people weren't. To a person, they weren't. They didn't do that part of the protocol, the deep environmental connection and meditation with nature, the silent journey inside. That cost them the benefits. I'm Gary Noll. We're going to take a quick break and come right back at you. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Noll. In this segment of our program, we're going to be exploring the coronavirus. What are we really up against? To help us with this, Dr. James Lyons Weiler is the CEO and director of the Institute for Pure and Applied Knowledge, which performs research in the public interest aimed at finding ways to reduce human suffering using funds donated from the public. His research program is currently focused on aluminum toxicity, autoimmunity, and the differences in health outcomes between highly vaccinated and unvaccinated children. A lifelong biochemical researcher, he is best known for contributions to advances in medical bioinformatics and for his three books, Ebola, An Evolving Story, Cures versus Profits, Successes in Translational Research, and The Environmental and Genetic Causes of Autism. A true blue academic, Dr. Weiler has directed the analysis of data from over 100 medical studies, served as founding editor-in-chief of the Journal of Cancer Informatics, serves on the editorial board of Cancer Research, and has published more than 57 papers in reputable journals. His blog is James Lyon Sweller, SWEILER.com. And it contains deep analysis issues that confront us today on the mismatches that exist between biomedical science and public health policy. His institute, IPAK, can be visited at IPAKnowledge.org. Nice to have you with us today.
Oh, good to speak with you again, Gary. Thank you.
The anomalies in the coronavirus strain's genetic sequencing is important. that seems to be a main issue, but one that I don't see anything being discussed in the mainstream media. Also, since coronavirus has been with us forever, and many of us have probably been infected with it in the past, but was brushed off as a bad cold or flu, since it brings forth flu-like symptoms, as many other viruses do, why is this one more virulent and more infectious since it has been traveling globally now and very rapidly? The form is yours.
Well, thank you very much. From the information that I've collected, and it was published in GenBank, as a bioinformatician who's analyzed thousands and thousands of DNA sequences, RNA sequences, protein sequences. In my career, I was the director of the bioinformatics core at the University of Pittsburgh and did bioinformatics in the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute as a faculty member there. I can say that there's something strange about the 2019 nCoV coronavirus genome, as we are referring to it. The genome itself appears to have modifications that, if you analyze the full sequence of the genome, it tends to cluster in a phylogenetic manner with bat coronaviruses. These bat coronaviruses are very well known, they're very well studied, and their relationships are among to other coronaviruses are very well established. And the bat coronavirus link appears to be true for most of the genes. That is, most of the genes that are in the genome appear to tell the same history of what this thing is most closely related to. In the initial report that came out, however, there was a gene sequence that they noted. This is not something I discovered. Only the Chinese reported that there was a gene sequence that didn't quite seem to belong there, that the gene sequence itself, they speculated, may have been due to recombination with an organism in nature, so that recombination in nature, such that one individual, either a bat or a snake, may have been infected with two types of coronaviruses, and while the virus was inserted into that animal's genome, they speculated that perhaps there was recombination among the segments of the genome, so that this virus picked up a new spike protein, which is an interesting story, and they had very scant data to support it. The genetic sequence didn't match any coronavirus known, and they reported that it didn't really match any other sequence that they could find in the national databases. There's three versions of national databases shared by the international scientific community. They all share the same content, and in the spirit of collaboration, they did a search to try to see if the strings of the nucleotide sequence actually matched anything anywhere. They reported they couldn't find any matches. Now, that particular gene, we'll call it a spike protein gene, encodes a protein that sits on the top of on the outside of a coronavirus coat, and it determines the mechanism by which the virus can or cannot enter into particular cells in different species or particular cells in a single species. So not all viruses can enter all the cells in our bodies because not all of our cells express the correct receptor. And the spike protein from, say, a SARS coronavirus or a MERS coronavirus, which appears to have come into humans in the past through camels from milk and meat, uncooked meat. These coronaviruses infect other, kind of specialize in which species they infect, but people don't realize they also specialize in the tissues that they can infect in a person's body. This particular segment of DNA encoding the spike protein, they couldn't find any match to any known sequence. But I did a little bit more of an informed search where I excluded the viruses from the search and I looked at commercial products. There are products that are out there that are nucleotide sequence based. The patent databases are filled with them. There's recombined viruses, there's vectors, a vector being like a plasmid. It's a nucleotide sequence that is known for its ability to insert nucleotide sequences into any number of organisms, from yeast to bacteria. They would probably use a bacteriophage, but nevertheless, you know, in molecular biology, there are a large number of different technologies that can be used to insert artificially sequences into viruses and into cells that are infected with viruses, and pick up a recombined virus that way. So my database search through bioinformatics found that there is a high similarity to a P-shuttle technology. It's a vector technology that was introduced in 1998 by Bert Vogelstein in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, so it's well known to molecular biologists. And in 2005, a group of Chinese researchers published a version of P-shuttle called P-shuttle-SN, and this P-shuttle-SN contains a component of a SARS protein for a spike. That's what I hit on. I found that the coronavirus from Wuhan, China, appears to be similar to, I can't say that it was constructed with, but it appears to be similar to the P-shuttle-SN sequence. And this is a grave concern, because all the scientists that have looked at the recombine in nature hypothesis, have ruled it out. The original paper doesn't appear to be a strong paper. They simply used information on what's called codon bias of the sequence rather than on the actual nucleotide sequence. And, you know, the fact that there's not a good genetic match to anything was problematic. So if natural recombination is being ruled out by the scientific community, that leaves laboratory recombination, and the fact that there is a SARS protein, which is a different coronavirus compared to the bat coronaviruses, there's a SARS protein, a SARS spike protein, in fact, in what otherwise would be recognizable as a bat coronavirus, seriously supports a laboratory origin of this virus. Now, we have to be really careful. We have to not immediately knee-jerk and point fingers at China, because laboratories all over the world, I've been very careful to do my due diligence to know who around the world is using recombined coronaviruses, specifically with the spike protein from SARS. Are they putting them into the bat coronaviruses? Yes, some are. So there are many laboratories around the world that are using the spike protein from SARS to try to develop vaccines. I can name the countries: Germany, the United States, Korea, Japan, and China. So when we see a recombined molecular biology product, it's very important that we don't just do a knee-jerk reflex and say, oh, this is bioweaponized. Because there's another hypothesis that I put forward. The other hypothesis, rather than a bioweapon, is that the Chinese were working on a recombined vaccine used for coronaviruses using a SARS spike protein. And in one of the laboratories, they had a beta coronavirus, a bat coronavirus, specifically, into which they had put a SARS spike protein using the P-shuttle SN vector technology. That wouldn't surprise anyone, because the World Health Organization and many other countries are fully well aware that the 2000s, the Chinese were actually moving ahead with development of SARS coronavirus vaccines. They actually went to a phase one clinical trial. The phase one clinical trial was small. I think they had 120 patients in that trial. But I don't know whether they, counter to international opinion on safety, I don't know if they didn't go ahead and do a larger scale phase two clinical trial or heaven forbid, a large phase three clinical trial where they vaccinated hundreds of thousands or millions of Chinese citizens in hopes of preventing them from acquiring any coronavirus, especially SARS, hoping that the SARS spike protein would confer immunity to them against another outbreak of SARS. So if they're using a coronavirus, like a bat coronavirus, as a potential experimental vaccine, there's a number of ways that they could have actually gotten this into the public. Number one would be that they may have accidentally created a very infectious and more lethal version of the virus in creating a recombined product that they were further testing in animals, and that a laboratory worker may have become infected accidentally with this more infectious virus and brought it out into the world and spread it. No one really has any faith in the Wuhan seafood market link anymore, because there are sporadic cases of disease that don't appear to be connected geographically to the Wuhan seafood market. But the Chinese CDC went ahead and tested hundreds of samples, I think 530 or so samples from the Wuhan seafood market of different kinds of meats from nature, and they found about 30%, they say, were infected with some kind of coronavirus, which is not surprising. A lot of animals have viruses, especially if you're eating wild animals, and you should thoroughly cook your meat, for sure. But if a laboratory personnel became infected with this and went out 5 days later, started infecting people, four or five people, that very well could have been the start, and that could be the geographic link to Wuhan, because there is a laboratory there. There are laboratories all over China that are looking at, in Beijing as well, that are looking at SARS recombined viruses for vaccine purposes. So if another scenario is that they went to the phase two or phase three large scale clinical trial, which is really problematic for the Chinese, because had they paid attention to the animal literature that everyone knows about, all of the early animal safety trials that were done in ferrets and in mice and in rats, yeah, they showed that the animals mounted an immune response against the secondary challenge with a SARS virus. And there are various technologies that people have put forward for potential vaccines for SARS. But they also noted that upon secondary challenge, the older mice tended to get sick and die. With a pathophysiology that is a progression of the disease that is very similar to that which we're seeing in the Chinese citizens who have died. All cases of death, there, as of today, there's 700 some cases, I think, of death from coronavirus. I have a database resource for that. Some 20,000 cases so far and 700 or so deaths. And each death, of course, is a disaster for a family. Each person is a mourned individual, a loved one. But all of the deaths, including the two that have occurred outside of China, one in the Philippines and one in Hong Kong now, are geographically related to either mainland China or to Wuhan, the city of Wuhan itself, which tells us something, right? So if we watch the death rate of people outside of China who were not vaccinated with my hypothetical vaccine, the theory that I have, if you will, that there have been human trials, and that these people are getting sick because there's a secondary challenge with another SARS or with the SARS, with a wild SARS. Maybe China was surreptitiously doing vaccine research that the World Health Organization thought was a bad idea, to get the jump on the market, to try to get a vaccine for the common cold. If somebody made a vaccine for the common cold, or, you know, for SARS, and it was effective, a vaccine for the common cold is right around the corner. And that is a, you know, $100 billion market, I'm sure. So there's a race for the vaccine for the common cold through SARS and through MERS and these other related coronaviruses, I'm sure. And, you know, the scientific literature, I want to emphasize again, it's just filled with examples of people trying to use this spike protein in a reconfined fashion. Some have put it into yeast. Some have put it into an adenovirus. They've put it into various different viruses under the assumption that they could control it, that there was no risk, and then that the risk would be seen in the animals in the early animal safety trials, and then the risk would also be seen in the human subject trials. But I noticed something in going through the literature. On the literature, that is the scientific literature, under the hood, if you will, you see these problems that Dr. Dale Brown of Ohio pointed out to me before I, he was very fundamentally important in pointing out these studies to me, before I formulated the hypothesis. You see the scientists actually saying it would be a really bad idea to make a human vaccine with this. You see them warning that in vaccine, human subject trials, that there we expect the same kind of problem, right? But then when you look at the official documents that are coming out of Sinovac, that's a company in China that makes vaccines, and the World Health Organization, and in chapters that are written about the coronavirus and the search for the vaccine, all of that risk language is gone. And I'm talking about, you know, 2008, say, until 2012, all of the risk language falls away when it comes to the commercialization process. And I call that translational amnesia. So if this new generation of scientists are reading material and not doing due diligence like I did and go deep into the literature like I often do when I become interested in a problem, they may not be aware that, you know, vaccinating individuals against the SARS using a recombined vaccine may set them up for a very high-risk morbidity upon secondary challenge. You know, that's the way vaccines work. People think that vaccines are a shield that go around the body. Vaccines do not prevent infection, as you well know, Gary. You still get an infection, but the vaccines hopefully help you mount an immune response that keeps the viremia low. So as an objective scientist, I don't have any financial interest whatsoever in any commercial product of vaccines. I find the technology fascinating. I find the sociological effects of forced vaccination intriguing. I'm an expert in the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, for which I am compensated for my opinion on what might have gone wrong in specific cases. But just taking a good, solid, objective look at this coronavirus story, what I'm seeing right now is the most likely scenario. And I want people to understand that this is very important. I'm not saying that I know this. I'm saying it's the most likely hypothesis that has to be tested and refuted if we're going to solve this with science, is that some way, somehow, a recombined vaccine made it out into the public, and it's highly transmissible, and it has a higher mortality in the elderly, the same profile we're seeing in the Chinese citizens. We will know, I think, in a few weeks' time. And it's sad to say this, but we will know if the mortality of this vaccine, I'm sorry, if the mortality of this virus outside of China is much, much lower, statistically zero, compared to the 2% rate that we see in China, 2 to 4% rate, I should say, that we see in China right now. Then I will say that, yeah, we probably should start asking China, did you run human subject trials with other
James, let me just interject, please. I've been watching some video from a so-called whistleblower in China, in hospitals where the hospitals are full. You can see the patients on the floor, in the aisles. There's no room. And he says the real number of infected people is over 100,000. How do we know that China's giving us any really accurate information?
I agree with you, Gary. I don't think we know. I'm going off of statistics from Johns Hopkins University, which of course gets it from World Health Organization, which of course gets it from China. So if it's 100,000, you know, we also don't know the death rate. There are, don't get me wrong, it's not just the rate of infection, number of diagnoses, and the rate of death. There's also the number of people that are seriously ill. You know, people. Now, what's interesting is that after the disease progression in individuals can take, it looks like, up to 10, 11, 12, 13, maybe 2 days, maybe 2 weeks. And there seems to be some kind of collapse after 2 weeks in the people that are most susceptible to death from this, where they get pneumonia, this upper and lower lungs. You know, there's an attack of the cells, probably an autoimmune attack, as you well know. Given that the basis, you've said so many times, Gary, that the basis of all disease is autoimmunity. But that the alveolar, the air sacs, fill up with fluid because the cells start dying. And, you know, right from the beginning when I first saw this, and I saw the CDC's response and I saw the World Health Organization's response, the first thing that they had to say was, we will have a vaccine right away. Okay? That's the first thing that they had to say. And I was kind of upset, because the first thing that they should say is, we won't be able to get a vaccine for this for a couple of years. So everybody in every country where there's been any reported instance of a diagnosis, a confirmed PCR diagnosis of this nCoV-2019 coronavirus, they should just presume that everybody in that town is infected and act accordingly. And what does that mean? It doesn't mean stay home. It doesn't mean panic. It doesn't mean rush to the market and buy up all the masks and, you know, gloves. And what it means is, become a responsible citizen. If you own a corporation or a company where it's a public place, have one of your staff members take bleach wipes every hour on the hour and wipe down the light switches, wipe down all the bathroom fixtures, wipe down the door handles and the doorknobs when people come and go. You know, wipe down all the common surfaces. If you run a grocery store, have the clerks wipe down all of the keypads. That's a very commonly touched place. And ask all the customers as they come to your store, please take this wipe and wipe off the handle of your cart. There's very common sense things that we can do, like we did it with Ebola in 2014. In Ebola, the scientists and the medical doctors who went over there to treat, they developed a culture where they didn't shake hands, they didn't high five, they didn't hug, they didn't kiss. Instead, they gave each other a fist bump using their elbow. They call it the Ebola fist bump. We can start doing that right now. And I'm so glad to be on your program to help get the word out. Restaurants should be super diligent in wiping down their menus after use. It's an additional effort on everyone's part, but it's a, you know, if we're going to remain have a civil response to this in terms of protecting people, there's no vaccine for this. And if it gets out where there are higher rates of death, right, what we want to do is, we want to understand that we have, first and foremost, a humanitarian crisis that has to resolve, no matter how many people die, with people caring for people. And so there are going to be people that, just like they're heroes that rush into a burning building, there are going to be people on the front lines. And we have to understand that, even as skeptical as we are of allopath, as skeptical as we are of those who promote vaccines and so on, they could very well become the frontline defenders against a very serious plague that, you know, could have a serious mortality risk. But after, you know, 2 or 3 weeks, if we don't see the mortality, I want to emphasize that we still have a humanitarian crisis. And I would argue, given my philosophy and sensibility, even if it was a bioweapon that China accidentally unleashed on their own people, because it wasn't all of the Chinese people that developed a bioweapon, if it is a bioweapon. It was a cadre of people who have a grip strength hold over the entire population. And so if the world has a humanitarian crisis, I mean, if this was happening in African countries, we'd rush in and we'd help. We've asked China for help. They said, yes, World Health Organization, come in and help. But, you know, we really need to start thinking about sending masks over to China and sending nitrile gloves over to China. These are loving, breathing human beings that they may have a very different government structure. They may have a different understanding of history. They may have a different culture. But it's so important that we understand that this is an opportunity for humanity to show its best, regardless of who made the mistake. And, you know, so I'm going to rank these hypotheses in terms of most likely to least likely, to recap. In terms of a natural recombination event, almost all of the scientific community has rejected that as extremely unlikely based on the sequence data. In terms of, and that only leaves a laboratory recombination event, right? So let's say that there's a 5% probability that it might be a natural recombined event. Let's not get up in arms over something that maybe I'm 95% wrong. Maybe it is a natural recombined event, right? And what if it's where we're not going to look at this as anything other than a humanitarian disaster, right? Because, you know, the majority has to have a voice here. It's the minority of people in power, in societies, in all the countries that make the decisions for the rest of us. And I think that we ought to take this opportunity to stand down against any form of aggression, any form of formal statement against the Chinese, because let's not be hypocrites. Let's not be hypocrites about the bioweapons we know that we're developing, okay? Let's not be hypocrites.
We've been developing those for 50 years at Fort Detrick.
Right.
Well, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much, James, for your insights. I have emphasized to this audience for 50 years the following. Don't assume that the money you're touching is clean. Over 3,000 different bacteria are observed on the average dollar bill. Don't assume that in the subway, the pole you're holding on to, the strap you're holding on to, the car handle you're getting into in a cab is sterile. It is not. Now, for those of us who grew up in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, we were allowed to go outside, play in the dirt. That actually strengthened our immune systems. And so we're healthier. You don't grow up in a bubble and completely sterile environment and be healthy. However, when you walk down a street and you see someone picking up a cherry from a fruit stand and eating it, they don't realize 24 separate hands have touched that before you have. None of them were hygienic. So just be practical, use common sense. Put your toothbrush upside down in a cup of hydrogen peroxide, because that's how people frequently reinfect themselves. Every time you talk on the telephone, simply take a little wipe. But alcohol, I have alcohol. I just have alcohol in a spray bottle. I just spray things, and then I wipe it off. The same for keyboards, telephones, doorknobs. And this way, you know, and even when I go to an elevator, I simply have a little Kleenex or tissue. I just push the button with that. Or if I have a key in my hand, I just push it with a key. I don't need to touch my finger on there, knowing there might have been 5,000 other people who've touched that, and who knows what viruses, bacteria, parasites, or microorganisms they may have. It's not to create paranoia, it's to create appropriate caution. What we know in science is the cautionary principle. If there's a likelihood I could become infected by something, then let me at least know that I can deal with that by prevention. And most of the time, we don't have any prevention in our society. It's not taught to us any longer. Should have been, isn't. So your advice is well taken. Your overview of the topic is well explained. We're better informed today. What we likely are seeing, according to what James has told us, is that somewhere in some lab, this would never have been done without the permission of the official ruling government leaders, they altered the coronavirus. Why they altered, we don't know. Was it to weaponize it, or was it to make a vaccine and get a jump on the world market? We don't know. If we don't know that, and we don't know what they used, how in the world can we create a vaccine, even if you were 100% pro-vaccine, if you don't have all of the information needed? That can only come from the Chinese government being completely open and honest. Unlikely to happen in the real world. So we've got to be on our own here. Eat your healthy foods, drink your healthy juices, and there are certain nutrients that are strongly antiviral. Manuka honey, one of the best there is. Just a little tiny dab, and you just allow it to dissolve in your throat. Pau d'arco, echinacea, astragalus, olive leaf extract, and wild oregano oil, all very effective. Colloidal silver, also effective, and especially for wiping down surface areas. People forget how many times in a day someone touches their mouth, touches their nose, and that's where we shed. That's where the body sheds viruses and bacteria through our mucus. Simply be conscious of that. Wash your hands frequently. I do not recommend using antibacterial soap because there's a side effect from that, but regular soap, but then simply spritz the hands, rub them together, and it's not spraying alcohol on a surface that destroys a virus. It is the rubbing that really breaks that surface area. So when you're washing your hands, wash them like a surgeon. You know, scrub them, then your fist in one palm, your fist in the other palm, then turn one hand over and rub between the fingers with the other hand, then reverse that. And then simply put some nice coconut oil, because coconut oil will help protect your skin from chafing and cracking being too dry, but it also is strongly antiviral and antibacterial. These are things we can do. Also, you can take a teaspoon in a smoothie each day of black cumin seed oil. That's really powerful. These are simple things to do. Quercetin is one of your strongest antiviral nutrients. In fact, when I was visiting the Linus Pauling Institute, Dr. Jawala showed me how they were actually destroying the HIV virus with quercetin by itself, even without the vitamin C. So these are simple things, non-costly, and something we can all do. I want to thank you very much, James, for being on today. My guest, one of America's really formidable scientists. He takes extraordinarily complex issues, both in the laboratory and in the literature, breaks it into lay language so we can all understand it and use it. And you can read his books, Ebola, An Evolving Story, or Cures versus Profits, Successes in Translational Research, or a very important must-read for any autism-damaged child, The Environmental and Genetic Causes of Autism. He's published dozens of papers in peer-reviewed literature, and he has been a director of an analysis expert from over 100 medical studies, and he is also the editor-in-chief of very important journal in science, public health, policy, and law. And so we thank him for being on today. I'm going to